Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
After 40 years in prison, even the annoying details of life on the outside can feel exciting.
This is the first time I ever paid a copay today.
Getting ex-felons to make health a priority. I'm Maiken Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
You measure a sample, but you measure millions and billions of molecules all at the same time.
You get to see these patients over and over again. They become part of your family.
It's a virus that likes to attack lots of different organ systems.
You know, everything falls apart.
How about a bag of frozen peas to keep you comfy? Plus,
bingo.
So here's this population that never gets studied.
Pretty much all of cell biology
there
needs to kind
be
of be redone.
For
I first
tests.
Opened a little box
before and there was selling. A cell.
All of the surgeries that have
not been
yet.
We're just giving you some of the medicine to your IV.
Basically, we wanted to know if there was any point to doing it.
Let me ask you something. When was the last time you were really annoyed about something related to your health care? A big bill, that specialist that won't be able to see you for 3 months, maybe that battery of tests that didn't give you any answers? Good health care is hard under the best of circumstances. And on today's show, we're going to up the stakes a little bit more. And we're going to look at providing health care in difficult situations with really tough patients, offering hope for people with relentless depression, stitching up a face with no practice, dealing with a sneaky kind of cancer, and finding sanity when your personal history has a really dark chapter. Let's start with healthcare after a lifetime in prison. Getting out of jail, there's often a pretty big to-do list. Get a job, stay sober, make up for missed birthdays, reconnect with families, maybe figure out how to use a smartphone. But people who help ex-felons with that transition say healthcare needs to be a priority. Tanya English reports.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm fine. My name is Daryl Conquest.
How are you?
I'm fine. And yourself?
You have a scheduled appointment today?
Yes, I do.
Daryl Conquest is just out of prison, and after 40 years inside, everything feels new.
I can't really put my finger on one simple thing. Technology, traffic, people, movement, being out after dark, seeing the stars.
Conquest is 65 now. He's tall and slim, and he has some natural gray and a little bit of orange henna coloring the fringe of his beard. He wears a kufi, the prayer cap many older Muslim men wear, and he has a chunky plastic watch that you might see on a much younger man. Even picking out his own clothes is a freedom to celebrate. So when he arrived at the health clinic and there was a glitch in his insurance paperwork, Conquest is patient and happy to be the one responsible for figuring it all out.
On your care plan, you have Part B that's active, but not A. So you might want to call Social Security and find out why you don't have Part A that's active. Okay?
Will do. Thank you. This is the first time I ever paid a copay today.
In 1975, Conquest stabbed and killed two people, a man and an eighth grade girl. He was 25 and an addict.
Heroin. I was a heroin user. At that time in my life, I was just all over the place. I was committing robberies. I used to travel up and down the East Coast just robbing people. I used to go to Washington, New York, Philadelphia.
He expected to be in prison for the rest of his life. And he says he thought, that's it.
My number was 58068. Yeah, that was my prison number, 58068.
But last fall, Conquest was paroled. The re-entry experts at the transition home where he lives say they never used to talk about health care.
We talked about people getting jobs and people paying fines and people participating in treatment groups. And now we are paying attention to it.
Pat McKernan is an executive with Volunteers of America, which operates residential programs. She's done social work with ex-felons for two decades, but says in recent years, former prisoners are older and sicker. Even younger people often have pent-up health needs.
For people who are coming off opiates or what have you, everything hurts. You know, that's when they start recognizing, I have an abscessed tooth. And you can't sit in group with an abscessed tooth, and you have to get those things taken care of.
The counselors know a local dentist who accepts Medicaid, and they send clients to a federally funded healthcare center in the neighborhood. They also help ex-felons build a legitimate paper trail to prove they qualify for benefits.
I may never have had a driver's license, and I may not have ever known where my birth certificate is, and I might have multiple Social Security cards. So having real identification for who I really am can be a challenge.
Because identification is such a problem, several states are working to sign people up for Medicaid while they're still locked up. When you're incarcerated, there's no question about who you are. So Illinois, for example, uses fingerprints to verify that an inmate is eligible for Medicaid.
Are you here for your from the X-ray results?
Right.
For that? Okay.
Exactly.
In New Jersey, where Daryl Conquest served his time, the Department of Corrections gets Medicaid enrollment started in the weeks before a prisoner is scheduled to be released. That makes the transition smoother. And when Conquest had pneumonia a few weeks back, he got care at the Project Hope Health Center in Camden.
Have a seat. This goes on your fingers for your pulse. Any work? And across your forehead.
The clinic has application counselors, but social worker James Comstock says in recent years, when ex-prisoners show up, often their paperwork is already in order. At that point, his job is to walk them through the routine headaches that come with health care.
Well, now you're back in the community and you have to get an appointment.
Meaning the two-week wait is kind of a shock to them.
Exactly. There's a fear when you come out. You know, how am I going to get this taken care of?
The health center provides HIV testing. The clinicians can prescribe the medicine that can help you kick a drug habit, and you can pick up condoms.
So maybe the first time they've had a sex ed conversation in a long time?
Professional one, yes. Okay.
Across the state line at a halfway house in Philadelphia, Tara Novelli is restarting her life.
Tara! Come on.
I'm like 5'4". I dyed my hair red. Olive skin, brown eyes. I'm from South Philly. I'm Italian.
She's just 50 days sober, so Novelli keeps a strict schedule to stay on track. There are Narcotics Anonymous meetings and chores.
Tonight is Thursday, so we're actually eating dinner now. And we have two groups tonight. I believe we have a Bible study at another group.
In 2014, heroin, crack, and a prostitution charge sent her to jail for 7 months. On the inside, she got medicine for her depression and anxiety. And she's not the only one. About two-thirds of women in the Philadelphia County lockup are on some kind of behavioral health drug. When inmates leave jail, they're supposed to get 5 days of medicine to take with them. But Novelli says she left empty-handed, and she wasn't enrolled in Medicaid.
I didn't get to home with anything.
How long do you think you waited before you had your medication?
I would say about 2 months it took.
She managed just fine for a while, but a few months later, Novelli had a relapse and landed back in rehab. She doesn't think it mattered much that she didn't have health coverage immediately, but that's the worry. Kriya Patel says when you're just out, scrambling to make good decisions, being off your meds lowers the chance that you'll be successful.
Do you need to find housing? You need to find a job. When are you going to find the time to sit down in front of a computer or travel to an office and actually fill out paperwork?
Patel is a college senior. She first visited the county jail in Philadelphia as part of a women and incarceration class at the University of Pennsylvania. This year, she won a $100,000 prize from her school to help female inmates fill out medical assistance paperwork.
The online application is a bit easier than the paper application, so people are rewarded for basic computer literacy.
Some inmates don't have those computer skills, but Patel says her team will help. At the state level, Pennsylvania just launched a similar pilot program at one of its men's prisons. Secretary of the Department of Human Services, Ted Dallas, says the goal is to help people avoid another trip through the system.
Whether you're a Democrat or Republican, I think in the last 5 or 10 years, folks have come to grips with this is smart policy.
Nationwide, about 600,000 people return from prison each year. There's a slogan that reentry advocates repeat all the time. They are coming home. And those ex-felons returning to the community are more likely than other people to use emergency rooms, more likely to have a string of illnesses, including hepatitis, HIV, high blood pressure, and asthma. For The Pulse, I'm Tanya English.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott, and today we're talking about providing healthcare under difficult circumstances. Our next story is about a dilemma a young doctor in training faced. Is care she could provide as a total rookie better than a patient not getting any care at all? Haley Goldbach is a first-year pediatrics resident in Philadelphia, and she spoke about an experience she had while working abroad during a recent Story Slam.
I was in Haiti between my third and fourth year of medical school, and I was in a hospital in Port-au-Prince. One night, it was sort of early evening, we were sitting on the roof of the hospital. That's where we sat after our shift was done. And just enjoying the night. And we heard a scream. And outside the gates of the hospital, we saw like a commotion and some blood. And I should back up and say that our hospital didn't deal with obstetric issues. It dealt with pretty much everything else, but not obstetrics. But a woman had literally given birth right outside the gates of the hospital. So, of course, people rushed to help. We were sort of, you know, we weren't on duty. I was wearing flip-flops. So we were just kind of watching. We see someone run by with a baby. The baby's crying. It looks okay. They run to the pediatric ward. And then they carry in this woman. And then someone shouts, "Does anyone know how to deliver a placenta?" So I was a medical student. Has any medical student ever heard a more perfect phrase, right? As a medical student, you can do very few things, right? Retract, take a terrible history, and you can deliver a placenta. So my hand went right up. Everyone looked at me. They were like, I just finished OBGYN like 2 weeks ago. I rushed downstairs. We held countertraction on the uterus. I spun it, and that placenta came out beautifully. We brought the baby over. It was just wonderful, okay? I felt great about that. Placenta, I was the placenta hero. But the next day, I was in the emergency room, and it was literally a room. Again, I was just observing and talking to people, and a young man came in. I don't remember his exact age. He looked like he was an early teenager. And he had a knife wound, kind of going from here, the tip of his ear, all the way to his vermilion border. And his story was absolutely heartbreaking. He lived on the streets. He was an orphan. And he had gotten into an altercation with another young man. It wasn't because they were mad at each other. It was because they were fighting for the privilege to wash a car to earn less than a dollar. Okay? So, you know, this we hear horrible things in global health, but here we had this patient in front of us. What are we going to do? And I was with some residents. So this hospital was staffed exclusively by foreign volunteers. And at this time, it was mostly RTs, nurses, and some residents from Canada, internal medicine residents. And I don't know the intricacies of Canadian training, but suffice it to say, these residents said, "I have not sutured anything in more than 3 years. She felt really uncomfortable. There was no one else who could do it. And they said, "Can you do it? You've just had surgery. You want to go into dermatology?" And I looked at this wound and I said, "I don't feel comfortable. This is not something I would do if I were in the States. I don't have supervision. This is a cosmetically sensitive area, and it's not fair. It's not fair. This kid's in Haiti. He deserves better than me." So we called the Haitian surgeon on call. There was one. And he declined to come. He said, "It's not life-threatening. I cover more than one hospital. I won't come." So there we were. This kid, huge wound, totally likely to get infected. His ability to follow up was pretty much non-existent. And so it was me or no one. So I did it. And I think I did an okay job. I closed the wound. My hand was shaking, but I did it. I did as best a job as I could. But I don't know if I should have done that. I didn't feel comfortable. I wouldn't do it for a patient here, but I did it for this guy. And I think that this exemplifies to me some of the competing values that we have when we do global health experiences. And I think truly, there is no right answer here. But it's something I think about a lot. And it's also something we face in our training now as a resident in the U.S. But I think it's particularly stark when we do global health work. You know, donating expired supplies, getting pastries that are day old for homeless people. Is it fair? No, it's not fair. But what do we do? So I don't have an answer for you, of course, but I will leave you with one of my favorite, probably overquoted, but I think wonderful quotes about global health. It's from an Aboriginal Australian activist. So, and I might be paraphrasing a little bit, but If you have come to help me, you are wasting your time. But if you have come because your liberation is bound with mine, then we will work together. Thank you.
Haley Goldbach is a first-year pediatrics resident, and she told this story as part of a Health Inequity Story Slam at the University of Pennsylvania. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Issa Ibrahim is an artist, a musician, and a writer. That is his more recent bio, but his past has a very dark chapter to it. He suffers from schizophrenia, and in February of 1990, Ibrahim attacked and accidentally killed his mother while experiencing a psychotic break. Reporter Laura Stercheski produced a story about Ibrahim for a public radio show called State of the Reunion in 2013. Let's hear an excerpt where he describes the fateful night that changed his life.
Issa heard a voice tell him he was Jesus. He turned on the TV and started flipping the channels. He saw messages from NASA, from Magic Johnson, about mass killings and the Second Coming. The people on the TV were talking directly to him, and he was talking back.
And my mom said, "Sounds like you're having a party up there." You know, people talking to me. I said, "Really?" I said, "Yeah." I said, "Mom, am I Jesus?" And she paused for a moment, and this is what will confound me perhaps for the rest of my life. And she said, "Yes." And I thought I saw in her face something evil. And I'm looking at her, and I see her face shifting as if a paved road in the summertime. You know, I'm seeing what I believe to be evil underneath my mother's face.
Ibrahim received an insanity plea. He was indefinitely committed to a psychiatric state hospital in Queens, New York. It's called Creedmoor. He stayed there for almost 20 years until being released in 2009. Now he's just finished a book about his life called The Hospital Always Wins, and I talked to him about that. He told me he discovered painting as a way to cope in the hospital. Then he became successful with his art. He was enjoying it. But despite that, he continued to get in trouble during his hospital stay. He behaved in a way that would keep him from being released. He made songs ridiculing the administration. He was mocking staff in his paintings. At times, he was deeply psychotic. He cycled in and out of the isolation ward. In many ways, he was sabotaging his treatment.
There was a sense, personally, of my not wanting to get out to some degree. I was punishing myself for many years, perhaps by getting involved in staff, knowing that it was wrong, knowing that this isn't going to work out. You'll always get caught. But a part of me felt like, well, you know, I didn't care for many years because I kind of wanted to heap as much punishment as I could on myself because I felt so bad and so guilt-ridden because of my mom.
But about 10 years into his stay, he had a breakthrough of sorts, and I asked him to describe that.
There's something Dirty Harry, here I'm quoting Dirty Harry, but there's something Dirty Harry says at one point in one of his movies, is that a man's got to know his limitations. And I really kind of hit a kind of rock bottom at one point. I had a major decompensation and had to be re-diagnosed again for like the fourth or fifth time. And then they put me on an injectable medication, which really helped my situation. I mean, there are a lot of people I know who are very anti-medication, but it really helped me. And I just kind of came to an understanding after like maybe 8 or 10 years that, you know, stop fighting this way. You know, choose your battles and try to formulate a larger goal. And I also kind of, in that awakening or in that enlightened moment, I came to an understanding that, you know, my mom wouldn't want me to suffer. She really wouldn't want me to spend the rest of my life in a mental hospital. My mom wouldn't want this, and I shouldn't want this for myself. And while I still struggle with guilt and feeling, you know, I'll wake up some mornings and go, wow, you know, and feel real bad about myself. But I should have a happier life than what was ordained for me by the system and by circumstances that led me into the system.
What keeps you healthy now? How do you maintain your wellness?
Positivity. Having a great support system. I've got great friends. I mean, I've lost my entire family, but I feel like I've acquired a chosen family. Staying active. You know, I paint all the time. I'm constantly writing. I make music. Creativity or the arts keep me alive. And I can't deny that I get my shot every month. You know, so the reason I say that is because during that moment of clarity I talked about, I was coming down from a major decompensation, and the next day after my shot, my thinking cleared up. It was miraculous. And it was like a clear indication that, okay, they've re-diagnosed you 3 or 4 different times. They don't quite know what's wrong with you, but you've got to accept that there's something going on upstairs in your mind that isn't quite right, that can be straightened out through the right medication. And I just thank God that I found the right medication, and just a very little bit, too.
Do you ever worry that the medication will stop working? Are you ever afraid that you might go back?
Yeah, that's a constant fear. You know, it's like anything. It's like having high blood pressure and being on a medication that works beautifully for 15 years, and all of a sudden it does something to your liver or your kidney, and you can't take it anymore. Then you have to take something else, and you don't know what the side effects of that will be. Or it's like any other medication that you're on that may or may not work after a period of time. I would probably decompensate and get psychotic or sick, or not dangerously so, but just going to that hellish place again is someplace that I'd rather not go to. So, yeah, it is a fear, but...
How old are you now?
I'm 50 years old. I'll be 51 in June.
What do you want to do with the next couple of decades?
Well, from your mouth to God's ears, let's hope I do have a couple of decades. you know, I spent 20 years dreaming of this, what's happening to me now. Being a moderately successful artist, an author, a musician, just kind of being free enough to create without boundaries and have people hear it, read it, see it, and appreciate it, and maybe even make it sustainable financially. So I'm living the dream. So if I could just continue doing this, I'd be as happy as a pig in mud, you know. When many years ago, all I had were 4 walls and a mental hospital and people going crazy all around you. So to be free and doing all this is beyond anything I could have ever imagined.
Issa Ibrahim is an artist, and his new book is called The Hospital Always Wins. This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. You can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Today, we're talking about delivering good health care in difficult circumstances. And here are 3 words that mental health providers dread: treatment-resistant depression. For people who suffer from this, nothing is working. Not talk therapy, not medication, none of the approaches that are available now. And if you think about the scope of this problem, depression is the leading cause for disability worldwide. The World Health Organization estimates that 350 million people globally are depressed, and up to a third of them are not getting better. Over the past few weeks, we've been looking into the big challenges facing the National Institute of Mental Health. The organization is currently searching for a new director. And in this final installment of the series, reporter Audrey Quinn looks at efforts to help people with this very stubborn version of depression.
When I first saw Victoria in the clinic waiting room, she struck me as slightly familiar, like one of my friend's moms from growing up in the suburbs. A little distracted looking, well put together. Up close, she looked more tired.
I've gone to therapists and psychiatrists ever since I was 15 years old. It works maybe while I'm there and they tell me positive things, but after I leave there, it just like kind of escapes my mind and it's just like I'm back to square one.
Victoria has the kind of depression that's often called treatment resistant. It's gotten so bad she's had to go on disability. She's been unable to keep a job.
I was always a workaholic, always like good attendance, always a hard worker, but mentally I just went into a bad state.
Victoria is not her real name. We're using it to protect her privacy. She's taking part in a study at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center.
Do you have any questions before we begin?
No.
All right, here we go.
Greg Siegel's a professor of psychiatry at the medical center. His research staff is setting Victoria up for her fifth day of an experimental treatment. He's been working on more focused therapies for people with depression like Victoria's.
So 50% of people respond to therapy, 50% of people respond to medication. They're not necessarily the same 50%.
It seems nuts to me, though, that this is the 21st century, this is medicine, that the best we can do is tell you a treatment has a 50% chance of working.
I absolutely agree. Every other medical specialty, we give you a test, and based on the test, we give you a treatment. In psychiatry, we just don't do the tests. Part of the problem has traditionally been that we don't know what to test. We don't know the mechanisms or how the disorders work well enough to do a test. We're just starting to learn this.
Matt Rudorfer heads the Psychopharmacology and Somatics Treatment Program at the National Institute of Mental Health, the NIMH. He says being able to diagnose a patient with depression doesn't necessarily bring us any closer to knowing how to treat them.
It is simply not that kind of one-to-one relationship as, say, taking an antibiotic, you know, to attack a specific bacteria which has been identified in a laboratory.
He says a good treatment would probably only have to act in one particular area of the brain.
But A, we don't know what that area is, and B, even if we did, we have no way of directing the medication there.
Helen Mayberg is one of the pioneers of this search for a location. She's a neurologist at Emory University. She says in the past, researchers have gotten too hung up on thinking depression is all about chemical imbalances.
The brain is not a bowl of soup, and you add the chemical and you stir. Chemicals work within networks, within systems, within pathways. And where in the brain a chemical may be working is as important as knowing what chemical you should use.
She found that people with really severe depression, the kind that just wouldn't go away after other treatments, they seem to have overactivity in the part of their brain called Brodmann Area 25. That's a couple inches behind the bridge of your nose. It's an area of the brain that monitors negative emotion. And when she did deep brain stimulation of that area, basically turning down its activity, the connected areas seemed to be able to function more normally. Most of her patients who didn't get better from anything else felt better when they kept getting the deep brain stimulation there. She also uses brain scans to compare depressed people who got better with drugs and those who got better with therapy.
People that did or did not get better on drug look different from each other. People who did or did not get better on therapy look different from each other. And then the ultimate test that people who respond to therapy have very different brain scans than people who respond to drug.
And they look different, of course, in specific parts of their brain. Greg Siegel back at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center has also been focused on Brodmann Area 25. Depressed people who have a hard time in cognitive therapy, they seem to have extra activity there in that area that monitors negative emotion.
So if you're sitting around constantly monitoring your emotion, you might not be the best candidate for an intervention that says, let's break away from that monitoring and do something about the thought.
He says what he thinks it really comes down to is an attention issue. These people are too caught up in their own negative thoughts, he calls them ruminations, to pay attention to therapy. During Victoria's test session, he explains to me a possible way around that. His lab was looking for a way they could still get the attention of someone really caught up in depression.
And it turns out just about anybody can get annoyed. So we said let's capitalize on that and effectively annoy the depressed people to make them better.
How they do this is by putting tiny electrodes on the inside of people like Victoria's wrist, and they have her ruminate.
Right. Do they feel good now?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
Then we will go back over and...
So in this intervention, we pass a weak current through their wrist, which kind of itches a little bit. It's a little bit annoying. and we see if they can pay attention to it. And if they can't, we can turn up the voltage so it's a little more annoying, and then they're good at paying attention.
And so it's like you're hacking their attention.
We are hacking their attention. That's exactly it. And when they can pay attention to the current at that higher voltage, we'll turn it down. And we'll keep turning it down until it's a tiny crumb of sensation. And when they can pay attention to that, then we've really hacked their attention. We've rebooted it.
The idea is after 5 sessions of this, and 5 should be enough, people should be able to pay better attention to things in the real world that they want to, like their therapy sessions.
Your brain is not a closed, immutable system. Your brain can be changed, and we can hack that.
Other researchers are trying to do this sort of thing by seeing whether we can test genetically what drugs will work for depression patients, or whether a simple questionnaire can tell you if you'll be responsive to therapy, and then to adjust a person's treatments accordingly. Victoria met with Greg Siegel in his office after her test session was over.
How was that?
It just helps me when I'm ruminating about that thought to realize that there's something going on outside of my thinking.
It'll take more time and therapy sessions to know if Siegel's intervention really improved her receptivity to therapy. But she says that feeling of having control over her ruminations, that's what she needs. As Victoria was getting ready to leave, I remembered to ask her one more biographical detail.
Do you mind if I say how old you are?
No, I don't mind. I'm 45 years old.
Okay, yeah. Great.
I still feel like I'm 18, so I still feel like I haven't grown up. But anyways.
I didn't really respond when she said this. I figured she meant she still felt young at heart. It's something a lot of people say. The interview seemed over.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
Oh, no problem. And I don't know if maybe you want to add this, is just because of me and my, like, negative thinking from when I was so young, that I wouldn't try to, like, better myself and just thinking that I'm a bad person. And since I was always running away from feelings, it kind of kept me stuck at, like, mentally being at, like, a younger age than I actually am. So I don't know if that makes sense, but a lot of times I just feel like I'm 18 years old because, like, I'm actually starting to grow as a person.
She says even though her depression's been treatment-resistant, she feels better that she's working at ways to fix that, like being in Greg Siegel's study.
Because I'm actually, like, dealing with dealing with everyday life instead of trying to run away from it.
Siegel says if the intervention with the electrical impulses proves successful, it's something patients with depression could soon be able to do in their own homes. The study still has a few more years to go. For The Pulse, I'm Audrey Quinn.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mikan Scott. How do you detect a cancer that has no symptoms? A lot of times it's because of chance and circumstances. Kelly Colavecchio and her husband Jim were ready to start a family, but then she received a stage 3 ovarian cancer diagnosis. Kelly is now 30 years old and she has the word faith tattooed on her wrist. It's a reminder to her that everything happens for a reason. She told us her story for this edition of our series, Patient Files.
This is me and my dad at my wedding during the first father-daughter dance. My husband and I during our first dance. I got married at 26. I thought I was too young to start a family. And my husband wanted to start right away. And he kind of had to talk me into it. And luckily he did. And we were having some issues, so we sought some fertility treatment. One test led to another test that led to another test, and they found I had a mass on my ovary. So we did just a biopsy. They weren't expecting to find anything. They just thought maybe it looked a little abnormal. They were going to biopsy it. But I remember coming right out of surgery and them saying, we didn't expect this to be abnormal, but it is, and I need you to see an oncologist. And I remember just kind of speechless is what I was definitely speechless. The only symptom I had was my pants didn't fit as well. I thought maybe I was just gaining a little weight. But looking back now, I guess that could have been bloating the first signs that they say of ovarian cancer can be bloating. But really, I felt fine. Everything else was fine. Luckily, we were trying to start a family at that time. After being diagnosed, we still had the hope that we could start a family. So we spoke to the oncologist. My oncologist and my fertility doctor worked together, and they decided that I had enough time to go through egg harvesting prior to my chemo. We did chemo for 6 months, 6 rounds. It was hard. It took a few months to get my strength back. It really wiped me out for a while. I was still working on and off. I work as a nurse, but I could feel myself. I was definitely weak. I gained a lot of weight. I just felt unhealthy. A year after I finished chemo, I was cleared by my oncologist and cleared by my fertility specialist to go ahead and pursue IVF. So we made the decision. We weren't sure what would happen after the pregnancy. It could come back. There was always a possibility it could come back. And we had 6 very good-looking embryos to work with. We made the decision to transfer 2. They both took...
James, say hi.
James Thomas was born first, and 2 minutes later, Brielle Marie. I would do it all over again if I could. After they were born, during my C-section, they did find new masses. They found new masses on my uterus and did some biopsies while they were in there at the C-section, and they were abnormal. We were so happy about the twins. It was the farthest thing from my mind at that moment, really. I remember him saying during the C-section, we see a growth. They knew I had a fibroid, but it wasn't normal is what Howie described it. Doesn't look normal. I'm going to take a few biopsies. We made the decision 6 weeks after they were born, that was the week of Christmas, to go ahead and do a total radical hysterectomy. During the radical hysterectomy, some more of the fluid biopsies came back abnormal as well. I had a few days where I may have cried myself while the babies were crying. All 3 of us were just crying at the same time. So right now, we're waiting for treatment decisions. There is a chance I might need more treatment. I mean, look at these 2 babies. I am so lucky. I know how lucky I am. I mean, if we weren't trying when we were, they may not have caught it in time. And here I was able to keep my uterus, do the IVF, have these 2 beautiful babies, and just in time before I had to have it taken out. Really, I'm pretty lucky.
Kelly Colavecchio lives outside of Philadelphia with her husband and her twins. This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott, and today we're talking about healthcare in tough situations. A lot of people escape difficult situations to experience a moment of health and well-being by running. Stress, bad moods, writer's block, a case of the Mondays, whatever it is, runners swear that they find relief as their sneakers are pounding the path. Reporter and runner Melissa Dahl of New York Magazine recently wrote about the efforts to explain this phenomenon scientifically, and she joins us now to talk about what she found out. Melissa, thank you so much for being here.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me.
You're a runner. What does a typical run look like for you?
A typical run. Well, I am really lucky and I live not even a mile away from Central Park. So I feel like I've just explored every path around the park. I mean, a typical run for me, I'll go for like 3 to 5 to 7 miles. And I've always loved the way that your mind just like travels here and there, kind of when you're out there on a run.
Now, scientists are discovering more about the benefits of running, and something they are talking about is neurogenesis. What is that?
Yeah, so this is so interesting to me. So neurogenesis is, until not so long ago, until from my understanding, perhaps like the late 90s, neuroscientists thought that you kind of got a certain amount of brain cells in your lifetime, kind of by adulthood. Like, that's it. That's all you get. And then they started to find, to discover that, no, actually, that's not true, that adult human brains are capable of producing brand new neurons. And the only way, this is so interesting to me, the only way so far that they've found of triggering the birth of those new neurons is exercise, is vigorous aerobic exercise, like running.
You spoke with a Harvard psychology professor, Emily Bernstein, and she did an experiment where one group of people ran for 30 minutes, another group just stretched for 30 minutes, and then all participants had to watch the end of the movie The Champ. This is a really well-known scene. There's a little boy, TJ, and he just saw his father win this big boxing match, and then his father dies. Let's hear that clip that everybody had to watch.
Wake up, champ. Don't sleep now. You gotta go home. Gotta go home, champ.
It's hard to even listen to a few seconds of that without starting to cry. So what happened to people in the experiment?
Okay, so what happened to the study participants who had to watch that clip? They were asked right after watching it how sad they were. And the people who had gone for a run were just as sad as the people who had not gone for a run. But what was really interesting was the scientists kind of kept them around and checked back with them later. And later, when they checked in again, the people who had gone for a run, they felt better. They felt better than the people who hadn't gone for the run. So the idea is that there must be something about running that helps us sort of regulate our emotions. I mean, I kind of said this in the piece that my boyfriend kind of has a thing where if I'm starting to get a little moody, a little cranky, he'll very nicely say to me, hey, have you been for a run yet today? Maybe you should think about that.
What is the magic length of a run? A lot of people say you have to run for at least 30 minutes before you start feeling those benefits. What did the scientists say?
The scientists really kept repeating that 30 to 40 minute window. The one in particular I talked to, who is a runner herself, she really kept repeating you have to break a sweat too. So it has to be, I mean, I guess the idea of it being vigorous aerobic exercise, it has to be, you have to be kind of working, you know, you kind of have to work. To work up a sweat. So it seems to be something about that is triggering these really great changes in the brain.
And finally, did scientists tell you anything about whether you should be listening to great things like podcasts while you run, or is it important to just be there by yourself?
That's so interesting. I didn't ask about that, but that is something I would love to follow up with. And I have to say, I used to always listen to music, and this is just anecdotal, you know, just my experience, but I used to always listen to music and always listen to podcasts when I ran. And I just recently stopped. And I mean, I came up with this story idea when I was on like a 9-mile run. And I think that Just personally, I think I get these benefits more when I'm not listening to something, when I'm just letting my mind kind of roam free.
Melissa, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Melissa Dahl is a senior writer for Science of Us at New York Magazine. You're listening to The Pulse, and finally on today's show, we're going to wrap things up with some music. Sounds catchy, right? But there's more to it.
Everything is sampled and manipulated from source recordings in the operating room.
That's Drew Daniel. He is one half of the electronic duo Matmos, and Martin Schmidt is the other half. This is a track from their album A Chance to Cut is a Chance to Cure. It came out in 2001 and it's definitely a Pulse favorite. We've used samples from it on our shows and we recently caught up with them and asked them to dissect how it was made.
In the case of LASIK, you're hearing samples of laser eye surgery. We recorded two procedures, one where the surgeon wanted us to just tape the DAT recorder and microphone to the laser machine itself, the other where we got to go back and stand in the room. And so you're hearing samples and manipulations of all of the audio generated during a LASIK surgery. It was my friend, the poet Monica Yoon, actually, who had the procedure done. I recorded some chin implants and rhinoplasties, nose jobs, and liposuction. My father is a surgeon, and so I grew up around medicine, and he specifically works on anatomy. He's written many anatomy textbooks, so I was always surrounded by the kind of clutter of his work. And I think it's natural when you're a child, you sort of fantasize about what your parents do and have this kind of, you know, your own personal sense of what it's about. So maybe an Oedipal takeover. And, you know, a doctor is a financially rewarding career path, whereas musician generally is not. And so I think in a strange way, it was a sort of mediation of shame to, like, turn being a musician into something that was sort of crypto-medical. I mean, we also, you know, the album was a way of dealing with the concept of medical technology in a very broad sense. So we were also thinking about the way that laboratory animals are used. So a song is made out of a rat cage. His rat bodies are used to create medical knowledge. We also made a song out of a human skull, since, you know, it's a classic tool in teaching anatomy. Our bodies, you know, are how we encounter the world, and we hear through our ears, but also we sense vibration with our whole body. You know, a strong sub-bass is something you sense in your gut. So I think that it's natural to want to make music out of the body. Maybe the body's the first instrument. Most infants are, you know, crying and screaming and slapping their tummies and sucking their fingers and their toes, and the body is the first object that you get to manipulate and play with. So it seems like a very natural starting place for us.
I'm not sure this music was so therapeutic for me. I don't know. I was taking it more literally, I think.
My father's pretty into the album. In fact, he's operated listening to it. Sadly, Martin's father passed away, but I think he was...
He heard the record, though. I think his feeling was the same as it is for most anything written after, oh, I don't know, maybe 1920, which is, I guess that's all right for people who like that.
That was Martin Schmidt and Drew Daniel, both children of doctors and partners in the electronic duo Mudmus, talking about their catchy 2001 album, A Chance to Cut is a Chance to Cure. And the two say they don't plan on revisiting the OR anytime soon, unless they have to. Their latest project is called Ultimate Care, and it's based on their washing machine. Are you intrigued? Check out videos of their recent stop in Philadelphia, and we also have music links on our website, whyy.org/thepulse. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Alana Gordon, and Todd Bookman. Charlie Kyer is our engineer, Paige Flager, the associate producer, Joel Patterson, our managing editor, and Megan Pinto, the executive producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening. Next time on The Pulse, technology, science, engineering, that's where the jobs are. But to land in those fields, you have to be good at math. And that's stumping a lot of college students.
I would leave classes and exams literally in tears. Like, I went to the bathroom and I cried after my math exam. Almost every math exam.
Could making math classes more engaging change the equation? Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and don't miss that episode of The Pulse.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse. Independence is coming to your neighborhood to help you understand healthcare options. Licensed agents can help prepare you for whatever may be ahead. Learn more at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless. Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.